Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Welcome to the Best of the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Thanks for listening. There's so many memorable guests and unforgettable moments from both radio over the years and this podcast. And I thought it'd be a great time during this vacation period to put some of this together so you have it at your fingertips. Conversations with my most incredibly scintillating guests, hilarious moments, all unforgettable. Enjoy it here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
In my meetings with President Xi, he and I spent a good deal of our time discussing the outcomes of China's third plenum. China's leaders have stated their ambition to move China toward a system where the market plays a, quote, decisive role. That will require deftness on the part of, and I'm confident he possesses it, the leadership of this country and the president. But, in fact, many of the reforms China's leaders are proposing actually match the priorities we have, leveling the playing field for private and foreign-owned companies. Protection of intellectual property and trade secrets, which is essential.
Wait a second. When did he say this? December 2013, Chamber of Commerce.
Oh, in Beijing.
In Beijing. Oh, okay. So Joe Biden soft-pedaled all the criticism on China. I mean, from they were raping us in intellectual property, subsidizing their corporations, dumping product into the United States, ignoring the International Trade Court decisions, rulings against them. They say, oh, yeah, I'll do that. And then they just don't do it. They do not change their ways at all. And they're like, well, this is a wonderful relationship. I love how he calls them. What does he call them? Xi or Z or Xi?
Xi.
In my meetings with President Xi.
Xi.
This is Xi? I think it's Xi.
It's Xi.
Xi.
Maybe that's a different president.
Yeah, maybe he thought he was meeting with someone else. Joining us now is our friend Peter Schweizer, and of course his phenomenal book, Secret Empires, How the American Political Class Hides Corruption and Enriches Family and Friends. Oh, friends and family. Great. He joins us now, and of course was phenomenal on this question of Biden and China. And very few people are talking about it. When we were talking about it, Peter, we got a huge reaction on the Ingraham angle to that segment. And let's break it down for people so individuals understand just how easy it was for Biden to help enrich his son through this cozy relationship with Beijing.
Sure. Well, it's always great to be with you, Laura. The story really begins in 2009. Joe Biden becomes vice president of the United States under Barack Obama. Hunter Biden, up until this point, was a lobbyist for online gambling companies. That was his career. He decides to set up a small financial investment practice with a buddy of his called Devin Archer, and it was half-owned by Christopher Hines, who is the stepson of John Kerry, who would later become Secretary of State. Now, neither of these people that were running it, Devin Archer or Hunter Biden, really had any background in finance. But, you know, why are you going to let that stop you, right?
Mm.
Flash forward to December of 2013. You just played that clip of Joe Biden's visit to China. Joe Biden flies over to Beijing on Air Force Two. On the plane with him is his son, Hunter Biden. Joe Biden, on that trip, he's there for 3 days, gets criticized by the Washington Post and other people, basically for going soft on the Chinese. Well, the most significant event of that trip occurred 10 days later, and that's when Hunter Biden's small investment firm called Rosemont Seneca Partners gets a $1 billion, that's with a B, billion-dollar private equity deal, later expanded to $1.5 billion, with the Chinese government. And this is really important to emphasize, Laura. We're not talking about a Chinese company. We're not talking about an American company in China. We're talking about the Chinese government saying to Hunter Biden, we're going to give you $1 billion to start with to invest and manage for us for a fee. Now, Hunter Biden had no background in China. He had no background in private equity. This was a sweetheart deal. It was done in the Shanghai Free Trade Zone. No other investment bank had any deal like this, not Goldman Sachs, not Morgan Stanley. They were unique. And that was the first of several deals that Hunter Biden's small boutique firm did with Chinese government entities beginning in December 2013 up until 2016 when Joe Biden left the vice presidency and the Trump administration came in. So it's a classic example of what I call offshore corruption. Joe Biden can't take that money himself. If his wife took that money from the Chinese government, they would have to disclose it. But you do not have to disclose the business dealings of your adult kids, even if they fly over on a government plane and you help them close that deal.
A lot of people in the summertime, you know, feel like your skin is not what it could be. I mean, if you're like me, you put sunblock on and that's really good. You should do that every day, no matter where you're going. Put on a good sunblock. That's just not on your face, but on your arms, anything where the sun is showing on. But also, as you get older, you get, you know, lines that, you know, you wish weren't there, especially along your jawline. And that's where my friends at Chamonix come in, because they have a great Genucel jawline cream, which I've used now for a couple of years. I've used the under eye for bags and puffiness longer, but the jawline treatment is a clean, incredibly natural, you know, effective product that you'll see the results from very quickly. And if you don't, because it has the Chamonix MDL technology, if you don't, then guess what? You get your 100% of your money back. Go to Genucel.com. That's just a great, great guarantee. And I promise you, you'll love it. So you text now, and the classic Genucel for bags and puffiness, that clear gel that you use under your eyes that I use, you get that for free just for trying the jawline cream. So it's very easy. All you do is text the word eyes, one, eyes, and the number one, to 77453. Or go to Genucel.com. You can do it there, too. And you're going to get two free gifts and free shipping when you order that jawline cream. Again, text EYES1 to 77453 or go to Genucel.com. Then he says, then Biden in 2016, he echoes what Obama had said a few years earlier. I think I played the Obama version of this, I don't know how many times on radio, because I was so shocked by it. But just when you listen to this Biden clip, you'll see the stark difference between the way Trump treats China and Pompeo treats China and the way they treated China. Let's listen.
I've spent a lot of time with President Xi. Even he acknowledges that the growth and progress in China has been a direct relationship of the stability that has been encouraged by U.S. presence. We're not trying to contain China. We're not trying to slow down Chinese growth. The growth of China is overwhelmingly in our interest.
Really? How is that necessarily the case when it's a communist country that routinely cheats and steals and goes into business partnerships, Peter, with American companies only to hollow out their most sensitive technology and then turn around and say, okay, we're going to make it better, cheaper, faster, and put you out of business?
No,
how is this good?
That's exactly right. And this is the great dichotomy that I think occurred in the Obama administration between the Pentagon, which was saying really throughout Obama's 8 years that China is a rival power. They're starting to take control of the South China Sea. They are engaging in cyber attacks against us. They are a rival power. And you have Joe Biden at that time, his son, lining up these very lucrative deals, not only with this private equity deal of $1 billion. Hunter Biden's involved with a company called Rosemont Realty, which is a real estate company in the United States, which he was sort of put on the board of and got a little bit of a stake of. They'd start doing commercial real estate deals with a Chinese entity called Gemini Investments. Well, Gemini Investments is owned by a subsidiary of the Chinese Navy. So you have literally the sitting vice president's son not only doing deals with the Chinese government financial institutions, but doing deals with commercial spinoffs of the Chinese Navy, which our military says has the goal by 2030 of surpassing us and achieving naval superiority. I mean, this is, in my mind, is unprecedented in the annals of American political history, that you have the family members of senior government officials at the highest levels engaged in large commercial transactions with foreign governments and even companies connected to foreign militaries. And the suggestion that this is not going to influence the manner in which Joe Biden interacts with the Chinese, treats the Chinese, is ridiculous. The Chinese knew exactly what they were doing. They were doing this to soften the resolve of the United States, and Joe Biden and his family were apparently very eager to take these deals because they took them.
Well, Peter, I think Biden is like so many of these folks, right? I mean, he's so many of these political people and business people who see China as just a pathway to make money, and maybe even some of them think China's going to win in the 21st century. So we're just going to make money along the way. But you can't have someone who's running for president feel that way. At least the people have to understand what this is all about, because even if Trump gets some great deal with China, or gets a decent deal with China, if Biden wins, he'll just come along and undo the whole deal.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is the Chinese government, having had this success with Joe Biden and with other people in American politics, you know, has tried. They have tried to actually float deals to the Trump family, because they're thinking, well, hey, we bought off these other guys. Why don't we just go ahead and buy off the Trump family? And the Trump family has not taken those deals. And I think they deserve a lot of credit for that. I want it to remain that way. But this is the model. The Chinese government has done this in Asia for years. They've done this in Taiwan. They've done it in Singapore. They feel like they simply can buy off elements of the political class in countries, and that is the way that they can expand their influence. In Australia, there's a major national conversation going on about this. We need to have it in the United States as well.
Now, and buying off departments of universities. There's a school that's starting in Washington, D.C., with a lot of Chinese money in it. And all these liberal parents in D.C., in upper northwest D.C., are saying, oh, you've heard about this school? I mean, it's going to be immersion China, and they're going to have the best labs and the best science labs and the computer science. And you hear about it, you think, wow, that's great. Then you look into it, it's like, oh, wait, China's funding this. It's in the old, Intelsat building in D.C. It's a shiny new headquarters of this new school that, even the building, even though it's kind of an old building, it looks like it's right out of Beijing. So they have enormous amount of money to play with, right? I mean, we gave them a huge amount of money, Peter.
They do. And you've got a lot of people, political elites in Washington, D.C., commercial elites at investment banks who are happy to do these commercial transactions. The problem is, you know, China is not a free market, and they don't think of these things as a free market. If they are going to offer a private equity deal to the son of the vice president for $1 billion, they are going to have strings attached to that deal. Everybody knows that. That's the way business is done in China. And China is dominated by this system of what they call the princelings. I mean, if you're an American investment banker and you want to do business in China, you basically have to go through the children of Chinese government officials to get approval and to get deals. They're called the princelings. Well, in the Chinese way of thinking, that's the way it works here. We can work the same thing in the United States. So why don't we do deals with the kids of American politicians or American politicians themselves when they leave office, because it works very successfully here. And unfortunately, you've got people both sides of the aisle who are prepared to take those deals because they are incredibly lucrative. I mean, you know, look, nothing personally against Hunter Biden, but he had no background in any of this. There's no way on earth in any sort of normal circumstance that anybody would entrust Hunter Biden with $1 billion, later $1.5 billion, to invest. He has no background in that area. It's done solely for political reasons, and the Bidens know that. They were just prepared to take the deal because it was going to bring enormous financial resources into their family. Here's the other thing, Laura, and I talked about this a little bit on Fox News. We know that it goes beyond China. It includes Ukraine. There is a bank account, financial records that we got access to. There was a court case involving Devin Archer, who is Hunter Biden's business partner, that was an account that was a pass-through account. Most of the money going out of this account at Morgan Stanley went to Hunter Biden. But what was going into that account was money from the Chinese, more than $3 million from Ukrainians. There's money from a Kazakh oligarch. There's $1.2 million from an anonymous LLC from a Swiss bank that has been implicated on three continents of money laundering. I mean, this is a dirty, dirty thing. And this is only one account. We know that there are multiple other accounts that Hunter Biden was drawing money from. And this is all going on during a two-year period while Joe Biden is vice president of the United States and is point person in the Obama administration policy towards China, towards Ukraine, and other hotspots around the world. So if you're a foreign official and you're going to pay somebody off in the United States to try to get favorable treatment, you're going to go to Joe Biden's family. And that's precisely what they did.
How is any of this legal? Like, I guess you can do business with China, but it would seem to me that when your father is engaged in negotiations with China and an adult child is benefiting from China, I mean, I have friends who are working in the White House who, when I bring a bottle of wine over to their homes, they say it can't be worth more than $20.
Right.
They say, don't bring anything that's more than $20. I said, okay, fine.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You literally.
This is Reuniti.
Literally $20. I think $20 or $25 is the maximum.
Right.
So
yeah, I mean, this is the absurdity of it, Laura. I mean, the absurdity of it is, you know, Joe Biden, you know, has been in politics for 40 years, you know, has to disclose if he has $500 in GE stock, and he has to disclose, you know, if he's got, he gets a $500 campaign contribution. But his adult son flying with him on Air Force Two to Beijing, China, to get a $1 billion private equity deal that he had no business getting. There's no disclosure requirement. So we found this by going through Chinese corporate records. That's how we found it. And the question of legality, wow. I think, is the reason we need to have a grand jury look at this. Because what the Bidens are going to say, their defense is going to be, Hunter's just a smart guy. The Chinese wanted him to handle his money. I think by any objective standard, that's ridiculous. And I think the preponderance of evidence shows he got this deal because his father was vice president and his father carried out very favorable policies towards the Chinese. And I think if it looks like a bribe and smells like a bribe, it is a bribe.
It's just like the Hillary, isn't it? Isn't this just like Hillary when she was Secretary of State and getting all that money for the Clinton Foundation? I mean, it's the same.
Exactly. Yes.
These people are grifters. I mean, it's just a grifter. And then they're worried about like some hotel that Trump was already trying to get built in Moscow that never even went anywhere. Meanwhile, they are making money off of all this stuff. It's just preposterous. Peter, thank you so much for joining us. Peter Schweizer, of course, his book, Secret Empires, How the American Political Class Hides Corruption, Enriches Family and Friends. Disturbing stuff, but we're going to stay on this issue. By the way, everybody loves summer. I do. It's my favorite season, no doubt about it. Even with the heat and humidity in D.C., love it. Love the long days and just the feeling of, you know, not quite as much stress with work and school and so forth. And that's when you also need the best sleep that you can get. And when you think you have sleep, you want the best sheets, the most comfortable, luxurious sheets that you can think of. And I can tell you, now that I've had the great pleasure of trying Sheik's patented sleep tech fabrics, they breathe 10 times better than traditional cotton sheets to keep you cool. They draw moisture away from the body to keep you dry, ensuring a deeper, more restorative night's sleep. And nothing compares to Sheik's and the comfort they have. So you also get the deep pockets. You'll see that the mattress fits perfectly with the Sheik's. It's fantastic. So there's no reason to wait. Try Sheik's and you'll love them. And all you need to do is go to trysheiks, that's try, SHEEX.com/Laura, trysheiks.com/Laura, and then use the promo code Laura and you'll get 25% off your purchase. So, and you're also going to get free shipping, which is great, and a bonus pair of pillowcases and a 30-night risk-free guarantee. Again, sheiks.com/Laura. Code Laura. Try sheiks.com/Laura, code Laura, for a better night's sleep. Thanks for listening to the best of the Laura Ingraham podcast. Do you feel like this country and individuals are more alienated from one another than ever? Like, even though we're connected, we're not together. That connectedness is really missing in American society. Well, our next guest has written a book on this, and he's going to tell us why he thinks this has happened and what we can do about it. And practical information for you. And trying to make your lives more meaningful, all of our lives more meaningful in this busy, crazy world we live in. All right, joining us now, I'm so happy he's with us, Tim Carney, an old friend. His new book, Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive and While Others Collapse. This does dovetail into our conversation about what's happening in Chicago and places like that I know well, Hartford, Connecticut, where you have increasing alienation of citizens and non-citizens, where you have a divide that doesn't seem to go away. And forget rich versus poor, black versus white. It's urban versus suburban, suburban versus rural. There are a lot of divides in this country, and much of it has been, I think, perpetrated, encouraged, triggered by really bad government policies. And I think Trump is trying to address some of them, especially with trade and bringing back almost now 500,000 manufacturing jobs created in the United States since Trump became president. It's staggering. Joining us now, Tim Carney, Alienated America. It's our book selection today on LauraIngram.com. Also our Facebook page, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. Tim, how are you, man? Good to talk to you.
Thank you for having me, Laura. Great to be here.
It's fantastic to have you on, Tim. You do sense, and boy, the news is really does, I think, elevate your book, the understanding behind your book, your ultimate conclusions. The news about Chicago and the Smollett case, the police chief today there saying we have enough problems here, we don't need any more problems like this, anger and resentment being fueled by the culture and politics. Tell us where we stand now and why so much alienation when, by all accounts, this is one of the greatest times to be an American today.
Yeah, so the story of how we got there is kind of the same story that Trump tells about trade and the death of manufacturing in the United States. It's that a couple generations ago, 1962, 1965, it was easier for a blue-collar guy to get a job that could pay his way, but also people were just more likely to live in closely knit communities connected to stronger institutions, most importantly church, but also, you know, Little League and a bowling league, all of those things. Those things have eroded. Often the factory closes and then the church closes and the local diner closes, but those important institutions they've eroded, they've been destroyed a lot of times by big government coming in, crowding them out, trying to chase a church out of the public square. And so it's the same thing. We've lost our connection to one another on a local neighborhood human level. And so then everybody turns for their politics to the national level, where things are always just going to be a lot more tendentious and a lot higher temperature than they could be if you're instead trying to sort of shape the world around you by being involved in a parish, by being involved in a swim club, by being involved in a bowling league.
And it's that sense of belonging, the lack of neighbors and neighborly connection. I find this in Washington, D.C. I find this in not every neighborhood in Washington, but even in Montgomery County, Maryland, or places in Fairfax County, where you can move into a really nice neighborhood, like an affluent neighborhood, and people don't know one another, Tim. They don't care to know one another. That I find to be really depressing.
That's true, but for the elites, and you know, I have a college degree, we live in the D.C. area, for the elites, it's easier to still go and find those crucial institutions. Whether it's, you know, we have a strong parish, the schools we send our kids to, you can belong to a country club, you belong to an alumni association. Mm-hmm. So when we say there's this huge alienation in the country and that people aren't as connected, a lot of people say, well, no, because I have these, the elites don't see it. They didn't buy it when Trump said the American dream was dead, because it's easier to sort of plug yourself into those important institutions. But you go out, and what I did in Alienated America was I went to the places where things were strong, but also the places where the American dream seemed dead, and you go out there, and what's striking is that it's not just sort of an economic downturn, it's a true social collapse. People, the churches are shuttered, the local coffee shop is shut down, the bowling leagues don't have anybody in them, and that is going on in the middle of the country, and it's totally being missed by the elites, who still have the ability to piece together their own civil society, even while the old ways are falling apart.
I think, Tim, you've hit on something so important. I mean, we remember the whole bowling alone. Remember the bowling alone analogy and what's happened. You talked about bowling leagues, and they were important. They were really important for middle America. People make fun of them, but it was a way for people to get together, socialize, talk about your kids. What can you do? I'm dealing with this. How's your mom? You know, it's a way people connected. You write about irreligious Americans and how they suffer in our society. I want to get to that in a moment, but I want to place something for you first, Tim. This was Hillary Clinton in March of last year in India talking about optimism and where she won and where Trump lost. Let's listen.
If you look at the map of the United States, there's all that red in the middle where Trump won. I win the coasts, I win, you know, Illinois and Minnesota, places like that. But what the map doesn't show you is that I won the places that represent two-thirds of America's gross domestic product. So I won the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward. And his whole campaign, Make America Great Again, was looking backwards. You know, you didn't like black people getting rights. You don't like women, you know, getting jobs. You don't want to, you know, see that Indian American succeeding more than you are. Whatever your problem is.
Oh, my gosh. You got to take a swing at that one. There's so much in there that your book relates to and refutes. Go ahead, Tim.
I was in the middle of writing the book when she said that, and it was almost – I got phone calls from everybody who knew I was writing it saying, she just gave you the opening to your chapter on this. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, that's how chapter 3 begins, is with that Mumbai audience and other liberals saying, oh, well, the problem with these people in the middle of the country is nothing's happened to them. They've chosen not to keep up. And it's just this amazing idea. It's sort of almost a social Darwinism that conservatives used to get accused of. Well, these people are good because they're succeeding, and those people are bad because they're not. And what I try to argue throughout the book is there was a real loss here. You guys on the left, you elitists, think that the only thing that was lost was sort of this racist, sexist hierarchy that kept white guys in charge. And they don't realize that the strong community bonds, these old institutions, the little leagues and the local churches, etc., they were incredibly valuable. In fact, they were necessary for living the good life, and that they have been lost. So that idea that nothing valuable has been lost is a huge part of how the same people who say that they're helping the poor and the working class are waging a war on the community institutions that the poor and the working class and everybody relies on.
Well, and I'm telling you, Tim, this sense was also echoed by some Never Trumpers. And I remember this, and these are people who I read and I enjoy their writing. I think they're, you know, really smart people and write interesting things. But I remember when David French wrote that piece about, I believe it was David French who wrote the piece
Kevin
about
Williamson?
Or Kevin Williamson, excuse me.
Yeah, Kevin Williamson.
Yeah, it was about Buffalo or Rochester, New York, and it was basically move. His point was like, why don't you just move? Your way of life is dying. And yeah, it's Kevin Williamson. Thank you. I don't want to drag David into it. But there wasn't some awful disaster that befell this community. Nothing happened to them, et cetera. You factories closed down, so move. And they called them dysfunctional downscale communities. I was enraged by this column.
Oh, gosh.
Enraged.
You know, I almost had to be physically restrained from writing a response to that one, I remember. And I dialed it back because I think he might have dialed back some of his things. But again, the problem here is people – it's this mistake that you – don't think a conservative should make, which is understanding that strong communities really matter to doing things right. There's a reason that we care about raising our kids, whether it's in a church or just in a strong family or with extended family, and that's because we realize that their outcomes are much more likely to be good if we can surround them with these things. And so when I look at Middle America in this book, I have to say it's not just a sort of an economic downturn that's leading to deaths of despair, because that doesn't happen everywhere that the economy slows down, but it's an alienation. That's why I use the word in the title, alienated. Mm-hmm. It's about people who don't have connections to others. And then it's just so much harder to make it in life, to try to raise a family, to even stick with your job if you don't have sort of a support structure.
So, Tim, what's the answer here? How do we proceed? We diagnose the problem, but I hear from a lot of my listeners and viewers that, okay, you always talk about how stuff's going to hell in a handbasket. How do we get out of this dynamic that we have? And are we beginning to pull out of it because of the rise in American manufacturing and the stronger economy?
There's no big government solution. The manufacturing will help, but I'm not confident. I mean, so many of if you brought back all the factories, a lot of them would be filled by robots. But yes, it's very important to have jobs that a guy with a high school degree can do and stay in for a while. But economics isn't going to be enough. One of the studies I point to in Alienated America is about the fracking towns that bring so much money to these blue-collar guys, which is great. But what doesn't follow immediately, they don't go back to having strong families. They don't go back to having all the good outcomes that some of the really strong communities do, because it takes a while. It takes a generation to build up those community institutions. So the first thing, and Trump started this, don't wage war on the church. Stop trying to drive it out of the public square. So that's step number one. That's what the federal government shouldn't do. But the next levels are going to be on the local level, honestly. It's going to be places trying to say, we need a downtown where there's going to be a mom and pop, where you're going to be able to go and bump into your neighbors. You're going to be able to go and interact. And just think of the serendipitous encounters you have in sort of a nice downtown compared to the inhuman way suburbs are built these days. That's going to have to be done differently. And so the last chapter of Alienated America has the solutions, but a lot of it comes down to, hey, you guys, readers, you're going to have to pick it up and start a t-ball team. You're going to have to start a neighborhood potluck. That's where the solutions are going to come. We know Washington can't fix our problems.
Tim Carney, the book Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse, with a kind of his own prescription for how things, not overnight, but will and can turn around. And it's like so much of our own individual lives, you know, our faith, our family, our circles of friends. I have a lot of extended family because I don't have a lot of, you know, biological family members around me because they're all spread out over the world, all over the world. But holding on to what endures. And that enduring sense of community that is lost in the impersonal big box stores or Amazon.com. I'm not saying government should shut them down, but I do believe that you begin not only to sell out your local community, you sell your soul out a little bit to these impersonal interactions that we only can have online. And it's up to us as individuals. And it's going to take, Tim, I believe, a spiritual revival that sadly a lot of people say only comes through hardship and tragedy. And
it seems unlikely because you think it's going in one direction, but America's had lots of spiritual great awakenings in the past, and we can have another.
Tim Carney, Alienated America, thanks so much. Pick up this book. It's really, really moving in so many ways. America, now and forever, you're listening to the best of the Laura Ingraham podcast. I love my two dogs. They deserve a life of love and dignity. You know how much I love animals. I know so many of you do as well. But what about our furry friends who are abandoned? Those who are also lost in the wilderness? Where do they go? Delta Animal Rescue is the largest no-kill, care-for-life animal sanctuary of its kind in the world. Their super sanctuary is home to more than 1,500 animals, and they've all been abandoned in the wilderness. You can help this beautiful mountaintop ranch continue its mission of compassion by including Delta Rescue in your estate plans. 100% of your donations go directly to the animals of the Delta Rescue Super Sanctuary. Look, you can't take it with you. None of us can. So why not give long-lasting gifts, life-saving gifts that will benefit our furry angels for years to come. For information on Delta Rescue's tax-saving estate planning options, visit deltarescue.org/Laura. That's deltarescue.org/Laura. Visit them and learn more about the great benefits of your estate bequest. Donate today at deltarescue.org/Laura. This is the best of the Laura Ingraham podcast.
Well, I was chosen. It's 18 of us to do the computer coding program. It's just an opportunity to learn coding, to learn web design, to, oh my God, it's amazing. This is bigger than I actually even thought it was. This is a lot. This is giving me an opportunity to be painted in such a different light. I don't have to worry about whether they're going to see me as a felon. My work can speak for itself. My the ability to fix or be the answer to their problem will actually be my ticket. And I don't have to worry about being a felon. That doesn't have to be the first thing on the list.
Taquiana Culver and Mabel Bassett. You're going to hear from them. They're inmates in Oklahoma who have been given an opportunity to better themselves, learn a really important skill, which is computer coding, to have an ability when they leave prison not to fall back into the recidivist behavior that, frankly, has plagued the former inmate population. And it's been a nightmare, especially for juveniles. And it's a revolving door back into prison. That has to be broken to the extent that we can. We have way too many people in prison in the United States. And I think President Trump has the right idea that if it's sensible, if it's pragmatic, if it works, we should be supporting people who can reenter our working population and be productive members of society and maybe even teach people something about the consequences of wrong decisions and criminal decisions and how much it hurts one's life, hurts others, of course, and sets you back until you have someone like Chris Redlitz, who is the founder of The Last Mile. It's a program that teaches inmates how to become entrepreneurs. He's also the managing partner of Transmedia Capital. He's wildly successful. But I heard about this from my dear, dear, one of my closest friends ever, Lee Habib, who actually started my radio show with me almost 20 years ago. And Lee has done great pieces both online, on radio, and for Newsweek on just wonderfully inspiring Americans. And when he told me about Chris in The Last Mile, I got teared up. I mean, and it makes me feel like I got to do a lot more than I'm doing. I just do a lot more than just raising my kids, but I got to find more time in the day. Chris Redlitz joins us now. Chris, how are you? How's that for an intro?
That's great. Really appreciate it. Thank you, Laura.
Chris, you know, when I talk to, well, sometimes I talk to folks about whether it's prison reform or criminal justice reform and giving people a second chance, redemption. We all need redemption in our lives at various points. Boy, I do. And I have. And I'm sure I will. But usually people say, well, why are you focusing on criminals? These are criminals. And that's kind of a knee-jerk response. But you found something very inspiring and surprising in the population of inmates that you have reached out to and are working with, and some really, really inspiring stories.
That's right. And you're right. You know, I when I first got involved in this, I didn't realize the extent of incarceration in America and the fact that 95% of the people that are incarcerated today are going to go home. So our question really is, who do you want them to be when they return to society? And that was the thing that really struck us initially about the extent of the problem. And it really needed a frontal attack on how do you resolve this? And that was the first question that I had, like, what is the response? What's the reaction going to be when we tell people that we're doing this? Because I come from Silicon Valley. I'm a venture investor, and this is completely foreign to my previous experience. But what I saw the first time I went into prison really struck me, that there are people behind bars who frankly never had a first chance, let alone a second chance. And those people really need to be addressed and given the opportunity to be successful. And that was really the motivation for us starting this. And I started it with my wife, Beverly. And we literally went in prison together two nights a week for a year, teaching this program ourselves, because we really thought it was important that we understood what the population was like, to get their trust, and also to prove to corrections that we were serious about trying to resolve this issue.
So you were invited to speak at San Quentin. I said, obviously, everyone knows San Quentin's one of the largest state prisons in the country, about business and entrepreneurship. And when was that? And tell us what happened at that first time you walked into San Quentin.
Sure. It was 2010. I was invited in by a friend of mine who was doing some mentoring to some of the students teaching English. And she said there were a lot of men in prison that had a lot of questions about business. And she couldn't answer their questions. There weren't any courses about business, about technology. And she asked me to come in, and would you just one night come in and talk to these guys and just, you know, give them a little bit of, you know, response to some of their questions. My initial response was no. Like, why would I want to go into prison? San Quentin's about 30 minutes north of San Francisco, so it's pretty close to San Francisco and Silicon Valley. But it's worlds away as far as, obviously, as far as culture and connection. But I did relent, and I eventually went in one night. And what I expected when I went in was for me to talk to this audience, get blank stares, and leave and never come back, because I didn't think they would really understand what I was talking about. What happened was that this 30-minute time slot turned into an evening discussion, and there were so many questions. Guys were handing me business plans, and I saw what I see in young entrepreneurs that I invest in. It's almost like that really look of determination and hope and desire and really a willingness to do whatever it took to create a better life after they served their time. So I related really my investment to what I saw in that room, and it really struck me, and that was really transformational for me. That was really the start of the program that evening.
You know, I've had actually a dream. I had a dream once. This is going to sound really bizarre, Chris. I had a dream once. I think it was after I was watching some movie that involved a prison. I don't know what show it was, but I was watching something. Then I had a dream that I was in prison. It was one of the most terrifying dreams I've ever had. And I thought, do I have a guilty conscience about something? I don't think so, but I don't know. I mean, but it was terrifying. And I woke up thinking, just our ability to kind of walk around and make choices and be able to get in a car and do the things that we can do in our country because we were raised a certain way, or we didn't fall into bad choices, or we didn't grow up in the wrong neighborhood. And sometimes I don't know, it's easy to lose track of that. And I think taking yourself out of your comfort zone in going into a place that has that type of, you know, primal challenge of you're not in control, then suddenly you're going to be released and you have to be in control. That's a wild dynamic in that you willingly inserted yourself into. I think a lot of people, and maybe even myself included, would be afraid almost of doing that, which sounds kind of wimpy, I guess, but it would. I think most people would be like, I'm afraid, but they're people. They're people who made bad. You're not in with like the mass murderers, right? You're in with people who, you know, can turn it around.
Well, I mean, people for violent crime, sure. I mean, they're in San Quentin, and most of the prisons we're in, majority of them are in for either drugs or some sort of violent crime. So, yeah, we're talking about people who have done something pretty significant to get there. And San Quentin's a place where it sounds interesting, but it's the place where almost everyone in California wants to be transferred to, because it has the most programs available for inmates. And when you enter prison for a violent crime, you may go in a level four prison. You have to earn your way down to level two, which makes you eligible to go to San Quentin. So guys have spent years and years and years being good citizens and trying to get to San Quentin. So when they get there, it's really a place that they can leverage the programs there, because San Quentin has more programs for inmates than any prison in the country.
Wow.
So when you get there, you do get people really willing and receptive to what you're offering. One thing we do require, though, is we have a zero tolerance program. And when I presented this, there was some question of whether it would work or not. But you have to, as an inmate, you have to be incident-free for 2 years prior to applying. And if you have an incident while you're in the program, you're immediately eliminated from the program, right? And that's been hugely impactful. It's had the accountability that not only when they're in prison, but when they get out, that's a huge part of why our recidivism rate is where it is today, which is zero.
But you're not working, and forgive me if this is a stupid question, but I tend to ask questions that just pop into my mind sometimes. But when you work with people, do you ever work with people who will never get out? And they just want to do something in their free time in prison, and I don't even know if they're allowed to do anything business-wise. Probably not, right? So, or is it always people who have an opportunity to be released?
Well, there are determinate sentences, so you have a sense of when you're going to get out, and then there are lifers, and lifers have to serve a minimum amount of time, and then they go in front of the prison board for a suitability hearing. So we take a percentage of our students are lifers.
Okay.
They're not guaranteed they're going to get out, but there's a good opportunity for them to be released. In California, for example, over the last several years, there's been a mandate to reduce prison population, and many of those have been lifers who have been found suitable. So it's not all the population guaranteed they're going to get out, but the majority of them are. So we really want people who have either 3 years to gate or at least 24 months to a suitability hearing before they get in the program.
And we're talking, and I'm so happy. I've been dying to talk to you. Chris Redlitz, who's the founder of the Last Mile program, which teaches inmates entrepreneurial skills and the response. And it's nothing like hearing from one of the inmates themselves. Darnell Hill is a graduate of this San Quentin program, The Last Mile. Let's listen.
I didn't realize the scope of technology over the period of time I was incarcerated, and not realizing the necessity that I needed to have and knowing enough about technology to survive in life. I don't think you can find any other program like it that helps prepare you for a society, integrating back into your family, integrating back into a relationship with my wife. Because of The Last Mile, they already had a community of people who they introduced us to that was able to read my profile to decide whether they wanted me to be a part of their company or not. In 2 months, I was given the keys to $1 million company.
That's just, that is beyond wild. That is incredible, Chris.
Well, I tell you, Darnell, first of all, I have to tell you that I'm the co-founder of the program with my wife, so I have to make sure that credit where credit
good
is.
Man.
And I started this.
Yes, good man.
And make sure that everybody's aware of that. Darnell is an incredible story because he actually was recruited basically by his dad to commit crimes. So he and his dad did robberies together, and they were arrested and convicted. They were actually cellmates in San Quentin in the early 90s. So here's an example of a guy who basically didn't have really a choice, and he served 24 years in prison. He was also married before he went into prison, and his wife, Sonia, waited 24 years for him, visited him almost every weekend, and we stood at the gate when Darnell got out with Sonia, and it was one of the most emotional things I've ever experienced. Darnell actually works in the community today with formerly incarcerated people. He actually works for us as well for The Last Mile. But he's a great example of someone who has turned this experience into something really positive. And, we're incredibly proud of him But it just shows that regardless of what your background is, if you have that desire and willingness to work, you can be successful. And he's a great example of that.
Chastity Choate, who's an inmate as well. Let's listen.
We all know that beyond these walls right now, our country is not very felon friendly. This program will give us that chance. The Last Mile believes they can change that for us, giving us a chance to prove that we are valuable, even as felons. We want to show our communities and our families that our addictions and the bad choices from our past do not define us. Our progress from today through the program, our success in the future, that will define us.
Gosh, she sounds smarter than most politicians in Washington. I'm listening to her, Chris, like, my gosh, I mean, why doesn't she run for office? I mean, I don't know what her politics is. Maybe I'd agree or not, but she's pretty articulate. This is good.
Well, it's funny. That was actually at our opening ceremony for the Mabel Bassett program, and she was not only addressing an audience, but Governor Stitt was sitting next to her. And MC Hammer was on her other side, so it's kind of intimidating.
Hammer time.
She did a great job. Yeah.
Oh no,
yeah,
that
she
is
was phenomenal.
So how do you get folks to actually do the work and show up at the prisons? How does the network work? How does, you know, mm-hmm. the practically speaking, how do you get your volunteers?
Well, we're funded by a variety of sources. In Oklahoma, Chan Zuckerberg had funded that expansion. Google's a sponsor, Kellogg's a sponsor. We have, you know, we have local foundations like in Oklahoma, George Kaiser Foundation, Lobeck Taylor.
Good.
You know, we have in Indiana, Zotec Partners and Simon Family, folks like that. So we do have funders. We do have a last mile staff of about 30. Mm-hmm. And we have facilitators that work inside the classrooms that are either funded by us or by the state. And we run programs. This particular program is 2 6-month cohorts, and they're in the computer lab at least 30 hours a week. So it's a full-time commitment for them. And when they get out of this, they are pretty competent in front-end engineering. But it's a commitment. So it's a year. They, as I said, they have to have good citizenship, but they also really have to be very diligent about the way they're approaching it. But it's really important for us to engage the business community. And that's why, this is not solely funded by any state. It's either funded solely by us and our founders or in a combination with the state. Because we really felt like having public-private partnerships is important. And a way to engage business community, not only in helping us run it, we do have a big volunteer resource as well, but also to get companies prepared to hire our graduates so they can see what we're doing. We invite them in. I've invited so many different CEOs from different Silicon Valley companies across the country to come in and see what we're doing so they can experience what I saw that first evening, but also see that these people are going through the process where they're going to be very productive when they get out. So that's really how we have grown it to this point.
Well, what I found so incredible when Lee told me about this is that you not only discovered this this pool of untapped talent, individuals who, but for X, Y, or Z, their own bad choices, their circumstances, addiction, could have gone on to do something phenomenal or just productive, what have you, in normal course of education and graduation. But you also ended up finding a demand in the business world coming out of the last 10 years. We'll see a dearth of coding talent in the United States, and the instant impulse will be, let's bring in foreign workers, let's get the foreign workers. And I've always said this, there are a lot of Americans out there who, if they had the option to be a coder or do something in a hospitality industry or something, they'd want to be a coder, and they could probably do it. And you're marrying those two facts that you figured out, the pool of untapped talent, nurtured them, and then you have the dearth of those skills in our workforce, and it's only going to get worse. That's a cool combination.
Well, there's a number that floats around that by next year there'll be 1 million unfilled software engineering jobs. So there's a lot of demand. And we've also shown that you don't need formal education. I mean, we have people that have zero formal education. They basically, you know, gotten their GED, and they've gone through this process and be able to be very productive people, you know, in technology. So it takes some of these preconceptions that people had, not only from incarcerated, but just saying you need some sort of education to do this. If you have desire and willing to put the effort forward, you can be successful. And also it's, you know, the bipartisan nature of this as well has really brought people together. I mean, we're in red states and blue states, and, you know, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, Beverly was back in the White House twice last fall in the discussions about the First Step Act, and to see that happen as well, it's really encouraging that this issue, you know, the issue itself is terrible, but the fact that we can bring parties together to resolve this is super encouraging.
Now, it's what we should be doing on a whole host of issues facing this country, and it's a rarity that we see this happening. Bipartisan, people who aren't even involved in politics, they see how just incredibly inspiring this is. It can't be all, you know, roses and sunshine, though, obviously, in this. There must be a lot of heartbreaks along the way, individuals who you thought would have great promise who ended up, you know, falling back into problematic behavior. Tell us about, you know, some of those challenges, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as I said, it's really rigorous. So most of that happens inside. You know, fortunately, we've had no one from the program recidivate at this point.
That's amazing.
But, you know, I think part of that is because of the rigorous nature of it before they get out. So, you know, I was, when we first started the program, and we said it was zero tolerance, I was the one that had to tell these guys that they were no longer in the program. And you're telling someone who's in for violent crime that they're gone. You know, that was a little daunting for me when I first had to do that. But, you know, once you set that, those parameters, and people see you're serious, then it makes it easier the second and the third time. But yeah, it was pretty daunting. I mean, it's, regardless, it's, you know, you're going into prison. So it's one mm-hmm. of those things where you have to have a confidence and comfort level that you're going to be okay. And here I am being my wife in prison too initially. So, you know, fortunately, we've never had an incident, and now we have the respect and response of those in the community that really, really support us. But, yeah, it was pretty daunting initially.
Yeah. Well, I went to a prison once to visit someone, and it was in Coleman, medium security in Florida. And that was – it's just a real experience going in and everything you have to go through to get into the prison and – if you have, by the way, if you have an underwire bra and you're visiting a prison, you're out of luck. Okay, you gotta bring a different bra. Okay, which I discovered.
That's right. Chris,
yeah. What was your background growing up? Can you tell us a little bit about your family, where you grew up, faith, just so our listeners have a better sense of you as a man?
Yeah, I grew up in Southern California, in a place called Palos Verdes. It's sort of a you know, upper middle class neighborhood. I have two siblings, two brothers, and, you know, we were very typical, I think, growing up. I mean, my high school is all white. You know, I didn't have a lot of experience at all. I, very sort of, I guess, insulated growing up. So again, I had nothing from my childhood to really draw from for this experience. And I got involved. I've been in Silicon Valley for about 25 years and, started a company here in the late 90s and then started investing in companies at that point and, started my venture firm about 10 years ago. So I've always been involved in entrepreneurial type of things. And to me, this was kind of an extension of that.
And did you have a faith growing up? Were you involved in a local, you know, church or other endeavors?
Yeah, I mean, we were Protestant, went to a church called Neighborhood Church in Palos Verdes, mm-hmm. right on the water, and very active. My dad was an usher and very involved in church. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I would think it's a pretty typical upbringing without a lot of
challenges and strife there. I was very lucky, you know.
Wow.
So I feel very fortunate that I can do what we're doing today and, you know, draw from whatever success I've had to be able to do this. And it's been more rewarding than any financial success, I can tell you that.
So you've obviously made boatloads of money. You've met all the cool people. You know the ins and outs of Silicon Valley and all the amazing technological progress our country has made and all those achievements. And yet it's helping people who literally have nothing behind bars that probably moved you the most of all of that. That's amazing.
No doubt about it. I have to say, like, when Mark Zuckerberg came in, he visited us in 2014, and, you know, to see him come in and have these conversations with folks and really look and with interest in their stories was really encouraging, and it really sort of set the tone for many other folks in the Valley to come in and get involved. So it really has involved so many people that would not have normally been engaged in this at all. And I think that's what we're trying to do, is create a conduit for others to first understand and then get involved. And when people understand the issue and the problem, they really do step up. And that's really been encouraging to me. Obviously, Silicon Valley is lacking in diversity. I think there's a big initiative to change those over
time. I saw that.
And I'm really encouraged by that. So, you know, hopefully we're on the forefront of that and helping change that as well.
Well, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And you're kind of living that.
Right.
Chris, thank you so much for spending so much time with us. And if there's anything I can do, although I'm not a very good business person, but I can teach writing. I could do that. If there's anything I can do to help, I'd be happy to help.
Well, I'll extend an invitation to you. If you'd like to come in either San Quentin or one or other location, you let me know and you can come and experience firsthand.
I would love it, Chris. Thank you so much for what you're doing. Founder of Last Mile, and we'll link up Last Mile's website on our Facebook page. You can learn more about them. And what an inspiring story. Thanks to Lee Habib for bringing it to us. Chris Redlitz on the Laura Ingraham Podcast. I hope you're enjoying this. Oh, the Laura Ingraham Podcast. This is the best of. And thank you for listening. We love your feedback. Always love your opinions. Want to hear from you. So you can email the show at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. That's ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Email me with your thoughts, or if you want to get on the show, just email me the topic you want to talk about or react to the topic we're tweeting or Facebooking out. Ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Keep the comments coming.